This is The Guardian.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled up on the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, friends. It's an overused phrase, but honestly, I think that we're in national treasure territory here. Arriving through that very front door in a moment, we have Graham Norton. He's coming over for a good old chat. Not before I fuel up with a snack. Look, I'm on the last of the Crimbo Ferrero Rochers. I'm going to make it into a hot chocolate. It's a little trick. I've been microwaving them and pouring milk, stirring, and basically just mainlining them, just pushing them into my face as quickly as I can. I love a Ferrero Rocher. Graham Norton is an Irish actor, comedian, commentator, and presenter. He's best known for his five-time BAFTA award-winning chat show, The Graham Norton Show, which has seen him invite celebrity guests onto his couch for over 15 years. He's an author with four novels to his name, and before all that, he acted in three episodes of Father Ted. Graham is such a staple on our TV screens. We all feel like we know him, don't we? But there are layers of mystery that I want to uncover. Not least, I want to know what this media maestro is munching on when the TV set is shut up for the day and he's back at home on his own couch. Okay, he'll be here soon, but first just a little sip of this. This is why people see me as a pioneer in food. Graham Norton, welcome to Comfort Eating.
Thank you very much, Grace.
Look, right now I am dressed up to the nines. I've got some jewellery on. I've got my makeup on to welcome an esteemed guest into the house. The truth is, I am feeling a little exposed, though, because we go to the same gym.
I know, that is embarrassing.
And not long ago, you witnessed me with a rather sweaty boob cleavage midway through doing six Bulgarian split squats. Right. And I just think there's something very vulnerable about being seen in very tight lycra.
I am so with you. Whenever I see someone in there, I think to myself, that looks like Grace Dent, but hopefully it isn't. And then I'll be saying to my trainers, we're kind of pushing something. I'll go, and then you've got to say hello. But yeah. Equally, it's weird. It's like we owe each other money or we've had sex or something.
Yes.
It's that vibe.
Graham Norton, this is a point in the show where you introduce me to the snack that makes you happy. I do not know what is under this tea towel. It smells quite nice. There's a nice aroma. Do you want to unveil your snack for me?
Well, all I'll say is I listen to this podcast and I think some people try very hard. You kind of think, oh, come on. But this is genuinely something, if I'm in the supermarket and I'm coming home and I just think, well, I'm a bit peckish, I know what I'd love. And it is this. It is a very simple Scotch egg. Waitrose Scotch egg. None of your fancy, because Waitrose have overcomplicated the Scotch eggs.
Yeah.
There's now kind of sort of Indian summer and weird ham weirdness. Yeah. This is your plain, and just have it with a little bit of ketchup. And today it's your cutlery, but I like to serve it on a small plate with a small knife and fork. So it feels like a tiny feast. You got me a small fork. Thank you very much.
Oh, so you feel like you're like a little Lilliputian.
Yeah.
First a Lilliputian.
Oh, I'm not sure I can eat this whole egg.
It's so big.
Alan Sugar has the small fork diet.
No.
Yeah. It's how he lost weight. He invested in a small fork. So he takes smaller forkfuls and I think gets bored eating. And you know, you can laugh at it. It worked. He did lose weight.
Anybody who's thinking that this is like a tiny picnic egg would be mistaken. This is a big, brassy, I'm going to say balls out Scotch egg. I'm sensing it's warm. Is it warm?
It's been microwaved for about 40 seconds.
Heavens above. You've microwaved it.
For 40 seconds.
40 seconds precisely.
Well, you don't want to, because if you do it too long, it gets soggy. But you just want to take the room chill off it.
Do you half it? Well, you know, you literally get the Scotch egg with your knife and fork.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone's in the history of Scotland.
Yeah, and then I would normally quarter it like that. So then you end up with a feast. A little bit of ketchup in the thing, and then you just dip and then you go.
Look at your face of absolute joy as you put that into your mouth.
I'm delighted.
It's the fact that the pork's grey.
Is that grey?
It's not brown, is it?
Well, no. It's not pink either. So you're safe.
It's like, I think a Scotch egg feels, in theory, it should be nice.
Oh, but in...
It's the fact the breadcrumbs aren't crisp. The pork no longer tastes of pork. How long's that egg been in there, though? Who knows?
That fascinates me. And how do you cook one? Like, I like buying them and eating them, but how do you hard-boil an egg? Do you then put it in raw sausage meat? It can't be. It must be cooked sausage meat. And then you deep fry it or fry it or something. I don't know how you make it.
Well, I know that if you go to a gastro pub, then the middle is lovely and runny.
Now, how you do that, I don't know. And actually, there are some other supermarkets who, I've forgotten that, they do a runny one. But they're quite hard to eat on the go.
The thing is...
I can shovel one of these in my mouth as I'm cycling.
Oh, that's a really erotic thought, actually. Just you at the traffic lights.
Yeah.
Slightly sweating, eating a Scotch egg like an apple.
Keep my head down so no one recognises me.
How long have you been eating Scotch eggs for?
Oh, a long time. I think, though, they're a since I came to England thing. I don't remember ever eating a Scotch egg in Ireland growing up.
That's when you knew you'd got to the big city.
This is sophisticated... This is sophisticated. This is like, wow, I'm living abroad. Look what I'm having.
This is your first postcard home.
Yeah.
Eggs.
Yeah, Scotch egg. Oh, of course, it is a Scotch egg. That's where they're from. Yeah, that's where they're obviously from. Yeah.
Let's go back to those days in Ireland.
Okay.
You were born Graham William Walker on the 4th of April, 1963, to parents Billy and Rhoda. You grew up in the town of Bandon in County Cork. Along with your older sister, Paula. Take us back to those early years of your youth. What did Bandon have to offer to Graham as a young boy?
I mean, very little, to be honest. It was just, it was like a waiting area. It was like a departure lounge is what it was. And it was as much fun as a departure lounge. I really was just waiting to go. Yeah. You know, I would watch telly. And that was my departures board. That was where I was heading.
If there was one show playing on this television in this imaginary departure lounge that made you want to leave? What is the show?
In a way, it could have been anything. Because I watched whatever was on. We only had the one channel, and I watched it all. But I suppose the big hitters would have been things like Charlie's Angels,
yeah.
Chips.
I remember Chips because that was two absolutely gorgeous men on motorbikes, wasn't
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
And then Charlie's Angels, just gorgeous women being gorgeous and fabulous.
And of course, it's that funny thing. When you're in Ireland, you think you're watching American television. And it's only when you get to America you realise, oh no, it's California.
Yes.
This is yeah. where they make everything.
What were your mum and dad like when you were a little boy?
They were kind of getting on with it. They were kind of making sure that me and Paula were being, you know, clothed, watered and fed.
Did they both work?
No, my dad worked for Guinness, the brewery.
Oh,
He started off as a service rep and then he was a sales rep, moved around a lot. And here's the weird thing. Now that I'm 59, I think he took early retirement at 50.
I mean,
yeah. I can't imagine just packing up tools at 50. And he didn't really have any hobbies or anything or interests, it seemed.
Yeah.
So I think it was quite hard for my mother after that.
Did they know you were going to go? So you're a little boy and you say you're waiting in the departure lounge. Did they encourage that or did they try and...
I think they tried to manage my expectations, you know, and this sounds like they were bad parents and they really weren't. This was all done with love. I think they sort of bred us for failure because that way you would never be disappointed or upset.
Mealtimes back then when you were a little boy, were they a family affair and what was on your plate?
They were very much a family affair. It was all, you know, the four of us sitting down together. And I was kind of growing up in, you know, coming to that, being aware of what I was eating, sort of late 60s, early 70s. And so there was a change. So, you know, we did have, there was lots of traditional stuff, you know, like the boiled hams. And my mother was great with offal. She'd stuff a heart. She'd do something with liver and, you know, she'd do all those things. But equally, we were beginning to get the, I can't remember, were they called Vesta? Vesta chow mein and stuff. In the box. With those little noodles that you'd fry in the pan and stuff. We'd get all of those. And that just seemed impossibly exotic and crazy. But my poor mother, so she would make one of those meals for all of us. My father, and he was not a demanding man. He was so sweet and gentle and not this guy at all. There had to be potatoes. It was not dinner unless there were potatoes.
See, I thought this was a myth of our Ireland, that there was these men that were passionate about potatoes.
I feel I might be one of them. I often in a posh restaurant will go, this is delicious. And I'm looking around like a dog. Anyone? No. Is everything on the table now? Is that all that comes with this?
Look, are you saying that your mother, when you were a little boy, used to stuff a heart and serve it to you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know what the heart of what? What would it have been? A lamb heart? It must have been a lamb heart.
It must have been a lamb heart.
I mean, a cow heart would be the size of a turkey.
I mean, she'd have had to have... had a couple of people to carry. That feels quite macabre. a lamb heart. I mean, back in the 70s, I definitely remember going to the shops to buy pig's hearts.
Oh, maybe it was a pig's
tiny
heart.
Tiny.
Yeah.
Little.
These were little.
What did she stuff it with?
Stuffing. Some sort of breadcrumby, sage, oniony. It wasn't like a Christmas stuffing. It wasn't like sausage meat stuffing.
It wasn't.
It was something else. I don't know what was in there.
I just can't imagine a little boy sitting there with his knife and fork, tucking into the valves and things that were...
No, I quite like that.
See, that is why you're okay about these Scotch eggs. Anything from then on, there's no arterial bleed or anything going.
No, exactly, yeah.
Our teenage years are a time of expanding horizons, pushing boundaries. Did the confines of rural West Cork offer much in the way of self-discovery and adventure?
A little bit. There were kind of exotic people who'd come to West Cork. You know, potters. And I remember Fred Astaire's grandson was at our school. I remember after he left, my mother bought his trousers in a second-hand uniform sale. I know, me with my hips, I managed to get into them.
Who were you running with?
No one, really. Very few people. I was friends with a few girls in my year. And that was about it. I was, you know... and I don't think I was particularly antisocial. I would chat to anyone and, you know, I would say the odd funny thing in class and stuff. So it wasn't like I was just moping. But yeah, equally...
You had one eye on the door already. Awful aside... Did you start to get adventurous with your palate in your teens? Did you have any really eye-opening moments around this point?
The big eye-opening thing in my teens was when I went on a French foreign exchange trip. Yeah. I went to a little town near Toulouse. And Gilles, he came to Ireland first. And so my mother was peppering about this because... There was all these horror stories about these French kids coming to your thing and they didn't eat anything and they went home emaciated and ill and you know, there were angry letters. So my mother was terrified. But anyway, Gilles arrived. Now, God loves Gilles. He ate everything, right? He really never complained. And, like, you know, he, some of the stuff he was having, you know, he was eating his instant whip and, you know, stuff that would make French people cry. But he ate it all. He ate it all. And I remember when we were at the airport and, you know, we were all flying off to France into the wild blue yonder. My mother, I don't think she did this, but I remember it as if she held my shoulders and she just looked me in the eye and she went, "Eat everything you're given." Yeah. Like I was eating for Ireland.
Yes.
You know, the pride of the nation relied on me. And it was as if the French family had heard her. Because, it was like I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. I mean, they really tried. They pushed me. And I never, ever said no.
I
ate it all.
Okay, I'm thinking tubey sausages.
All the pissy sausages. Lights.
A lot of spleen. They like a kind of spleen, a lining.
The worst one was, for breakfast this was, a thing called tête de veau.
Yeah.
And it's basically sliced up calf's head floating in aspic. So you're cutting it in and you're like, clearly that's a nostril. Like, we can't even pretend that is just a nostril. You know, at least have the courtesy to mince it up and wrap it around some egg and deep fry it. But no, just a nostril. I ate that. Here's the thing. I'd never eaten cheese before I went to France. I was about 16, maybe 17, did not like cheese. But it was great. It opened up all of these tastes to me. And it made me, you know, it. Because I think when your kids, all children are conservative with a small C.
Yeah.
And it knocked that out of me really early doors.
You grew up with a pen pal, very glamorously called David Villapando.
I know.
One summer, whilst at university, you travelled to America on a student visa to visit him in California. How did this very wholesome summer jaunt end up being over a year long?
Well, what happened was... I mean, David Villapando, so I had lots of... This was back in the late 70s. Everyone had pen pals and I had loads of them. Indonesia, you know, Australia, Canada, everywhere. But the one I settled on was David Villapando. And we sort of came out to each other in our letters. But of course, I'm living in Bandon. He's living in Los Angeles, California. So...
How did the conversation even... come round to this in the letter? Because my experience of pen pals in the 70s was that you just almost bored them to death.
But those are the foreign ones. Did you not have any American ones? Because you could actually have conversations with them. Whereas if you're talking to France or Germany or somewhere, it is very much kind of like...
Je joue au babyfoot.
Yes, and we do 2 years of exams before we go to university. Yeah.
But yeah. with David Villalpando, it went from that to...
Okay, and then it went to he was doing things about it. So it was like little pale blue airmail porn would yes. arrive every couple of weeks with his adventures. So it was very exciting. So when I was getting out of Dodge, there's this J1 visa you can get if you're in Ireland, which means you can work in America. So I went there and like... it was the early 80s. But even so, I went with, I think, £200. And that was going to last me for a month while I got myself settled.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was gone in 10 days, tops. And I had a Rambler bus ticket. The bus ticket ran out in San Francisco, as luck would have it. So I'm now in San Francisco. He's in LA. And this is the bit of the story where I did not come out of the story well here. I sort of forgot all about him then, so I never met him.
Oh my god.
And I, as an adult, I've tried so hard to find him. I don't know if he's still in the land of the living, but I have emailed a lot of David Villalpando's and never got a reply.
What happens next? Why didn't you go home when the money ran out?
I got a job because I was able to work. So I got a job in a French kind of sandwich shop. It was called yeah. Vie de France. And I enjoyed it so much, met lots of great people there. And then I was living in this hippie commune because it was cheap rent. Mm. And then that was a totally different experience.
It doesn't feel like you were a hippie at this point. You know, like you weren't a hippie in Ireland. You're quite a, you know, a straightforward person. And then suddenly you're in San Francisco and...
Well, I suppose because it made economic sense to be a hippie... Because so if that's how you get a cheap room, yes, I'll do this.
Did it have a name?
It was called Stardance then. It's called something else now, and I can't remember what it is, but it's still there.
I've got to ask, what's the food situation like in a hippie commune? A, do you all have to eat together and pretend to like Moonbeam or whatever, your neighbour's lentil dal? And is it always dull?
Do you know what? It was never dull. Dull every day, but never dull. And it's where I kind of learned to cook. So now I cannot cook for one or two. I mean, seriously, if I make a meal, six people could easily show up every time. Now, sadly, I eat that.
That's the problem.
That is the problem. But I worry about quantity. Yeah. So I was cooking for like 12 or 14 people. And I mean, when you say dread the night, I mean, the nights that my name came up on the chore wheel for dinner, they must have gone, oh no, it's him. And yet, when I went back, there was a reunion, kind of 25th anniversary or something a few years ago. And I went back and I met one of the women there called Erica. And she went, oh, Graham, we still make your soup. We call it Graham's soup. I'm like, what? What soup? And of course, you will roll your eyes. It was a leek and potato soup. And I don't know how I knew to make that. I mean, I imagine Erica taught me how to make it. Yeah. And now I've given it back to her as my soup.
So in a hippie commune, was it all about free love and free expression and...
There was some free love, but like I remember even as that young kid resolving to not come back to Ireland and laugh at them. Because by the end of that year, I had such respect for them and their beliefs and the fact that they're still, you know, out there. They're trying to still kind of protesting for change and, you know, trying to lead by example in a way that I wish I had those sorts of principles. It's kind of one of the biggest regrets of my life is that I don't live my life like that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Like so many people arriving in London in the 80s, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, your 20s were spent working in restaurants. Were you a good waiter?
Oh, see, now I started off as a really good waiter. I was very keen. I wanted the people to have a nice time. I was very enthusiastic. But I was Irish. So, like, I think back now, things like, you know, at the end of the meal, I'd bring over the dessert menus and go, would you like dessert? And people would go, no, thank you. And I go, are you sure? Like, yeah. Mrs. Doyle from Father Ted. Because in my head, that was etiquette. Yeah. You know, you forced dessert on people because it was their job to say no. And then it was your job to go, ah, you will. Ah, go on, go on, go on, go on. And people must have just thought I was the pushiest waiter in all of London. And then over the years... boy, did I fall out of love with it. And after about 8 years, it's really lucky I was able to get out, or there might have been a fatality. I might be in prison now.
One of the places you worked, which kind of blows my mind a bit, was the Eagle.
Yes.
In North London, which is regarded as the first gastropub.
Yeah.
You know, downstairs, you'd be found pulling pints. But in the end, it was the upstairs room that changed your life.
It was, because I left drama school, wasn't working, and then, but still wanted to show off. So working in restaurants, I developed this stupid thing of when I was, you know, polishing glasses, and we're all standing around just gassing before we opened for the day. We'd be polishing glasses, and I would put the Irish linen tea towel over my head, and I would do... like an impression of Mother Teresa of Calcutta, which is funny for about 20 seconds, maybe 15. I would start every show with, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the unborn.
Like that. So she was kind of, is there a lot of hand-wringing?
Very, yes, a lot of hand-wringing, but she would do things like she would demonstrate the Holy Trinity through using Tupperware. Because, you know, they'd go into three into one. Do you see?
Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Holy Ghost.
Yeah. So it was clever stuff.
Right.
But there was an hour of it. Anyway, I said, can I use the gallery upstairs to put on a little show? They said yes. Then people started saying to me, oh, I hear you're doing a show, you know, in a couple of Thursdays' time.
Yeah.
And that made it happen because, you know, I wasn't really going to put on a show in the gallery because... Yeah. Come to it, I'd have to write one and da da da. But now it was happening. So I did it, and I'd sent out all these press releases and things and little bits of Irish tea towel stuck to cards. It's like a relic. And and people came, and Emma Freud from Radio 4, Loose Ends, she came, and a woman called Judith Dimmitt. I think Judith Dimmitt maybe came because she heard it on Loose Ends. And she was involved in the Pleasance up at Edinburgh. And there was a cancellation. And so I got straight in to do kind of 2 weeks at midnight in the Pleasance.
I mean, that's scary, though, because you went from, I mean, essentially fannying around in a kitchen to at the Pleasance with two weeks to fill.
Yes.
Really quite quickly.
It was very quick. You know, on paper, great that I've got this kind of high-profile... kind of entree into the world of comedy and the Edinburgh Festival, it doesn't pay any bills.
Yeah.
And there's, well, and it took me a couple of years to figure out that Mother Teresa was quite a niche act It was never really going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. I was never going to do the comedy circus as Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
So then I did some kind of other comedy characters. And then finally, I kind of bit the bullet and went, look, this is stand-up. So I might as well just call it stand-up. And that's when I started making a living.
So Graham Norton, your first eponymous show starts airing 1998. It is a heady mix of chat show, sexual innuendo, and audience participation. Often all at the same time. Having a TV show named after you, it must feel normal now, because you've been on our screens for 25 years. It feels like your career, though, really turned a corner at this point. Is there a specific moment that you thought, holy hell, I'm really famous now?
Ooh, I remember there was we were in Five Nights a Week by now. And Big Brother was on at the same time as us. And it was a Thursday recording. And we had Dustin Hoffman on. And we did a sketch where he was impersonating people from the Big Brother house.
Yeah.
And it had gone really well. And Dustin Hoffman had been this great guest. And myself and Jon Magnusson, the series producer, and Graham Stewart, the executive producer, we went out for dinner. And we were in the OXO Tower, you know, right next door to the studios there. And we were up on this, it was a lovely night, it was a balcony looking out over London. And I remember that night feeling like we were at the center of something.
Yeah.
It felt very now. The success of our show, the huge success of Big Brother, those guests, we're in London town, we're literally sitting on top of it. And it's rare that you get, it's normally you get to appreciate that in retrospect. Normally you look back and go, God, do you remember we were kind of the thing then? But we were able to appreciate it while we were in it.
Of course, you're now most often seen on our screens hosting The Graham Norton Show on BBC One, your chat show, which sees you and the great and good of Hollywood, pop megastardom and society at large, sitting on the sofa having a natter. Like, one of my favourite things about the show is this intoxicating mix of people you get on together, people who would never have crossed paths otherwise. So you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, Miranda Hart, Ronnie Corbett and Usher. All sat next to each other, which is incredible. So this sofa, it reads like someone's fantasy dinner party lineup. Whose chemistry has really surprised you?
Ooh, a lot of people's chemistry has surprised me. Where they have a kind of inner confidence that I didn't expect them to have. Or sometimes it's a serious actor who turns out to be a clown. Like Dustin Hoffman was one where I was like, I was sort of dreading having him on because I just thought this is going to be such hard work. And then he showed up and he was just an absolute hoot and a holler and a laugh. And then these younger people like Chris Pratt from all the Jurassic Worldy movies. He's so great.
He's a revelation, yeah. Isn't he, Chris Pratt? Now, doesn't he really love The Only Way Is Essex?
He does, and does a really good Essex accent. It does an amazing Essex accent. And then, you know, then there's people like Miriam Margolyes, who, her thing doesn't surprise me. Because, you know, I know Miriam and you know what you're going to get. But what she brings to the chemistry experiment of the couch is pretty special. And it's so great because you see the American sitting beside her and they think, oh, I'm sat beside some dear old grand dame of British theatre or something. And you see her, the little twinkle in the eye, and then you hear it comes, and then boom, and stand back.
I always wonder about the placement of where people sit on the sofa. Right. Do some stars ever come along and expect to be maybe closer to you because that's a better seat? And do they row with each other?
That does happen, weirdly. And it's our fault, really, because what we should have done all along was mix it up so that the biggest star wasn't near to me. But now it is seen as the person sitting next to me is the biggest star on the sofa.
Okay.
Which sometimes means that huge stars, for whatever reason, have never sat, like Bradley Cooper has never sat next to me.
Yeah.
There's always been someone more famous than him.
Has anybody ever walked out and just changed seats at the last minute?
That has happened once. Mm-hmm. And they walked out together. There were two actors. They walked out together. And one of them was supposed to be sitting next to me. And the other one just didn't sit down. He just waited. It's quite something to see. Yeah, just waited.
I mean, obviously, you're not going to tell us who those people are. No, but
you could spool through.
But so the reaction of the other guests, what did they do? And what were their names?
The other guests, I don't know. But also, they wouldn't have cared because...
They couldn't see.
Yeah, and also, we're not down that end of the couch anyway, so it doesn't matter who we're next to.
Would you argue that even if you're at the other end of the couch, it doesn't really matter because you're equally as focused on everybody, so it's all nonsense?
Absolutely. It is all nonsense. I think often what it means is your product will be the first one discussed. But as a guest, as someone, if you just want to show off and tell stories and be funny and be part of the show, sit wherever you like. And, you know, I always say that to them. There will be a moment in the show when I'm looking you in the eye and asking you a direct question. But equally, if I'm not, if you have a question for someone else, ask it. If somebody says something that reminds you of a story, tell it. You know, if it bombs, it doesn't matter. We'll cut it out. It's fine.
Do you ever take your guests out for, and I'm going to use an 80s Beano term, a slap-up dinner?
Not now. No, yeah. Not now anymore. But back in the Channel 4 days, because we couldn't get guests, I was like a kind of spoilt brat millionaire where I would just go, I'd like to meet the mother from the Waltons. And they would fly in Michael Learned. And so I would have to be London host. Yeah. So I would take Michael Learned and her husband out for dinner or whatever. And I had a slight obsession with Cagney and Lacey back in the day. Yeah. So Sharon Gless was coming to London. So that was all fine. But she didn't know the show. None of these people knew the show. Just Channel 4 sent them money and a ticket. Mm-hmm. And they were like, all right, I'll do it. So Sharon Gless was going through customs. And the guy obviously recognized her and said, oh, what are you in town for? Oh, I'm doing something called So Graham Norton. And the guy in immigration like pulled a face and went, really, you're doing that show?
Oh my God.
And so she was like, what? Oh. So then she started getting herself into a panic, thinking I've made a terrible mistake, I shouldn't do this show. So I had to take her out for dinner. So I took her to that place. What's it called? Mirabelle?
Yes.
The what was his name?
That was Marco Pierre White.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a good dinner.
I love that restaurant.
I mean, that's a fancy place.
It's just sitting there empty now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, yeah. Someone should open that.
Yeah.
Anyway, took her there for dinner. You know, not cheap. I'm spending a lot of money on Sharon's dinner. Charming, charming, charming. Everything will be fine. It'll be all lovely. Da, da, da. Spend all this money. Sign the thing. Da, da, da. I'm taking her out. She is appeased. She's looking forward to the show the next day. We get out. The guy's there to hail us a taxi. And he looks at her and looks at me. And he goes, oh, you're not doing his show, are you? Bit of a waste of money.
You've spoken candidly about relationships in the past. You said every man, no matter how young or fey, has something of the alpha in him. Having a famous boyfriend must add a particular kind of a dimension to a partnership. What impact do you think fame has had on your past relationships?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because on one level, I don't know because I can't turn it off and on. So it... The relationship I've had, I'm in them.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty clear within a date or two if people are only interested in that.
How do you know?
Oh, you know.
Should I give you some hints?
Okay.
it's when they say that they've been working on a book and do you know any publishers?
I had that after a relationship broke up. And I think it was like a blackmail threat. And
a book about you.
Well, it was about him, but I was going to be in it. And I went, oh, that's a really good idea. Let me put you in touch with my agent. They'll get you there. And because I knew he was never going to write a book.
Do you, when you meet somebody and they desperately want to go to a red carpet event?
Yeah, that's a big red flag. The other one is if you kind of go, oh, should we, you know, on a Tuesday, should we meet for dinner? Where do you want to go? And suddenly they blip to some huge, big, posh restaurant. You're like, okay. Yes. I kind of thought more, I was thinking more Nando's.
Yes.
But okay, let's do that. That kind of frightens you off. I remember going on a Tinder date once. And, oh, this poor guy. I felt so sorry for him. So we'd met prior to this at some charity event, some Irish charity event. And so when we meet, and I knew that we had already met at this charity event, I said, oh, so how come you were at the charity event? And now this was sort of nice of him, but sort of stupid of him to tell me. He went, oh, my friend is a journalist, and she was invited to the charity event. And I think friend was more than, it wasn't more than a friend, it was his flatmate, I think, was a journalist. God. So we're having... We're having a first date chat, you know, do you have any brothers and sisters, that kind of stuff. But she'd obviously pushed him out the door with a list of questions. And bless him, he was so bad at it. So I'd be going, you know, yes, I have one sister. She's 4 years older than me. She's a librarian. And then he'd go, have you ever been drunk presenting your show?
No.
I'm like, I wonder if that's from the list.
Oh my gosh.
Bless him. Yes.
So how long did you go out with him for?
5 years.
Well, dating, we can put that to the side because earlier this year, he got married.
I did, yes.
To your partner, Jono.
Yes.
He is vegan, and you, as we've heard, certainly are not. Does it lead to arguments?
No, it really doesn't. Mm. What it's led to is that I now more or less live in a vegan house.
Yeah.
You know, the dog eats meat, and I can smuggle a Scotch egg in occasionally. But by and large, it's a vegan household. And I held out for things like yogurts and regular milk for a while. But I have to say, I've given them up because actually, you know, I found very nice yogurts. I found really nice milks and I don't need them.
It feels as if the relationship is about give and take. But you have said in the past, I would prefer to live alone for the rest of my life rather than live with towels that were folded incorrectly.
It just means it's that thing, isn't it, where I think if you are alone, the longer you're alone, the harder any of this stuff is because there's a place for everything. And, and so sometimes I have to remind myself to prioritize Jono and our relationship over, you know, where something should be. Yeah. You know, I have to kind of go, no, Graham, this thing brings you so much joy and happiness.
Yeah.
And actually, that is just you being a bit of a dick because that's where it's always been. It doesn't need to be there.
Your new book is called Forever Home, your usual blend of dark humour, dry wit and emotional heft. It's set in Ireland, where, as we've said, you still spend some time every year, along with houses in London and New York. Of the three places, in which are you happiest?
It's difficult because they're happy for all sorts of reasons. You know, so long as I've got Jono and the dog, then that's great. London is where my friends are and where my career is. I can relax in Ireland in a way that I can't relax anywhere else. And that's where family is. And that's probably where, you know, I'm at home in a very different way there. Because I know those people as much as they know me, if you know what I mean. But equally, New York is great just because there's anonymity there. And it's sort of old people fun, New York. I mean, it's full of young people fun too, but it's lots of old people fun, like theatre and exhibitions. They deliver everything. Mm. You know, it's good as you get a bit creaky.
So you're not moving into that stage in your life where you just spend the whole time in Cork, like growing pumpkins or wholesome fun?
No. If I ever grow anything, it won't be a pumpkin. It'll be potato for the winter, tomato for the summer. Thank you very much.
You said that there's a lot of luck in the industry, a lot of luck in this game. Do you consider yourself lucky?
I have to. I mean, if I'm not lucky, who is? You know, so I have to say that I'm lucky. A friend of mine, her father died recently, and at the funeral, she quoted him, a thing he used to say, "You don't need to be the best, you just need to show up." Yes. And I think that's what I've done over the years, is prove that to a fault. It's about the, you know, carrying on. That's the key.
Graham Norton, thank you for coming to my house. Thank you for bringing me the Scotch egg. And thank you for comfort eating with me.
Thank you.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Jack Clarriman. The executive producer is Lucy Greenwell. The music was written by Axel Kakutier. Mixing and sound design was by Solomon King. If you like Comfort Eating, then please go and leave us a review, and you can follow or subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And use the hashtag ComfortEatingPod to get in touch about the podcast or share your own comfort eating delights.
This is The Guardian.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.